This is the ColoradoHockey.com podcast brought to you by ABSFAM, ABSFAM.com. Today we have an in-between episode for you, which is a long format podcast where we get to know somebody in the hockey ecosphere who is smart, brilliant, interesting, or otherwise worth talking to. And today is definitely no exception. We have a man who is not just a cool guy. He's a mathematician and a teacher, and he loves hockey, and all three of those things together make him a really cool guy to talk to. He looks at things that we look at every day, but in a different way. He comes up with stats and he turns them into visualizations and makes it easy for guys like me to understand what's going on at a very, very detailed level. One last note before we get started, we are aware of some of the audio issues that we've been having in some of the last few podcasts, but this is the internet and these hour-long podcasts will have a couple issues within. I assure you it's absolutely worth listening to, and this guy's absolutely fascinating. And now, without further ado.
Yeah, huge shout out to the ABS fam. Colorado hockey's coming in, man. Let me teach you how to dutchie. On the ice, the dutchie touch. Hashtag volley volley. The crazy saves this so gnarly. The Condor and Landy. Team Utes is sweeter than candy. Colorado hockey's coming in. Colorado hockey for the win. Tune in to the podcast, we're live. Colorado hockey has arrived. ColoradoHockey.com.
So my name is Micah Blake McCurdy, and I'm a mathematician.
So and I when people ask you, like at a party, is that what you tell them, that you're a mathematician?
Yeah, I kind of like seeing the crazy look in their eyes when they, you know, like they give you that sort of dentist look.
Where they're, right. They're not sure they want to hang out anymore.
It's I've actually had a couple people say, how is it possible that you're a mathematician? You seem so normal, which I think is a great kind of backhanded something.
It is, yeah, definitely a backhanded comment in that. But at the same time, you're able to look at things in a way that other people aren't. You have a lens that most people don't have. And like I said, it's really interesting to me. But at the same time, I think it offends some people. I think some people are very put out by the idea of science, data, anything getting in the way of their sports. Is that something you run into?
Now and then. For some people, it's less fun if there are numbers attached to it. And I think a lot of the time that just comes from visceral reactions from their past about how they don't, you know, they didn't enjoy math classes, or they, you know, or they think that people are trying to say that, oh, you shouldn't enjoy stuff. But I personally find that the more I know about the details of hockey, the more I enjoy it. And the more I know that what's unexpected and what's likely, the more that I can enjoy, you know, seeing it.
Yeah, I'm a guy, I have a bad case of technolust, and that doesn't just apply to gadgets and iPhones and watches and whatnot, but I really like the idea of innovation, and I like to see things looked at in a different way and things kind of taken to the next level. And I think some of the work that you do, and definitely some of the stats that you have, I think this is going to be sort of the future of hockey in a way. And I've been doing a series about the future of hockey, and this is one that I intend to get to, but I'm really curious to know from you, how do you think this is going to fit in 5 years from now versus right now?
So it's hard to tell exactly what's going to be taken on and what's going to be left aside. And so, of course, when you're making up new stuff, there's going to be a certain amount of things that just don't stick. But the thing about stats, too, and part of what makes the whole, like, stats versus, you know, eye test or whatever argument so frustrating is that people are already using stats. And the only difference between a stat that's, you know, considered esoteric or nerdy and a stat that's considered basic and fundamental is just time. Though all the eye test people are happy to cite stats like goal counts and assist counts, I mean, and plus minus and a handful of other stats. And if we don't like those stats and we prefer other stats, you know, there's really no difference there. It's just some things we're used to and some things we're not. So I think the one big change that's going to come along is, especially if I have anything to do with it, is more visual presentation. Less looking at numbers on a page and more looking at comparing different groupings of people in things that aren't necessarily just a single number.
Like, well, that's taste.
Sure, good.
Oh, I was going to say, that's kind of the key to anything, right? I mean, any innovation, especially something that, I mean, you could call this disruptive, I guess. Maybe not so much in the hockey industry, but throughout the world right now, the data being collected is huge. And there is an art in taking it from something that is pure data into something that data scientists can understand, but then something that people like me can understand. Because when I look at the graph, sometimes they just don't mean anything to me. I don't understand what I'm seeing. And I think once we get to that stage of just kind of dashboarding things so that anyone can get it, it's going to be huge.
Yeah, that's a constant process for me too, right? Is that because I make a lot of stuff so that I can understand myself, and some stuff I make with a specific point to get across. And so then when I put them out on, you know, Twitter essentially is my main testing ground for this stuff, but on the website too. And then people say, you know, sometimes people say, oh, this is tremendous, I love it so much. And some people are like, you know, some people just blow you off. And other people say, ah, you know, I kind of see something here, but I don't see all of it. Like, it's something I'm still missing. Those people are incredibly useful from a professional point of view. People who are willing to talk to you about, you know, what it is clear and what's not clear. And that process is ongoing all the time, where you're trying to turn stuff from being something that puts all the data together to something that actually gets a point across really fast.
And so if you won the lottery and never had to work again, would you still care about this? Is this still something that you would do? Is it more of a passion than
oh, yeah,
project or work? It's just, this is how your brain works. This is what you care about.
This is the common thread is visual display of information, actually. I was a pure mathematician for a long time before I started working in hockey. And there I was working on how to do more abstract mathematics using pictures instead of using symbols. I really like visually understanding things. So that angle is definitely where I'd be working no matter how much money I had.
Do you imagine that that hockey biz in 2 or 3 years is going to be just much more visual than it is now? Do you see yourself iterating it up to something a lot more visual language versus, I mean, graphs are a visual language, but something even more simple and more digestible by anyone?
That's what I'd love to have. I don't know what, you know, there's always going to be trade-offs because there's a lot of information, and a lot of what goes on in hockey is actually chaotic. And so, you know, so if you're telling that story truthfully, there's going to be chaos there in all the data that you take. But yeah, I mean, my hope is for HockeyViz to grow into a really prominent place where there's a lot of visual learning going on.
And the ultimate compliment would be that people share it with other people because they find value in it and respect your data. So I'd love to see that for you.
I mean, Twitter is great for this. I see a little bit of it too, where you know, I mean, obviously it's my website. I can see when people post stuff from it, and mostly they talk to me about it. But every now and again, they talk to other people, and it's fun to see other people, you know, start to use it for their own purposes and not just for conversations with me.
And who do you think uses the stuff you're putting out there the most? Is it fans or teams or scouts, or do you think coaches, or
you can't be sure. I mean, certainly fans. That's my main connection is with fans on Twitter. You know, I hear stories from people that maybe some scouts or maybe some teams are using it, but people are pretty, you know, I don't know if that's true or not. People are pretty tight to the vest about that stuff. When I make it, I try, my primary audience is always myself. I mean, I'm a very nerdy sort of fan of this. You know, I want to know lots of different information at once. And so that kind of well-informed fan is my main audience. And that could cross over a lot with people who are working for teams.
And it's not so hard to find like-minded people on the internet. I mean, even if it's only 1% of the people care about it, that's a big chunk of the internet. So I really like that you're not just creating content for content's sake. This sounds like this is something where you're putting out in the world what you would like to find yourself. How a musician would write a song he'd want to hear, things like that, you know?
Yeah, and I make as a point of discipline, as well as a way to reach more people, I make a point that every time I do something, I do it for all 30 teams. So I design it in a way that, like I make graphical decisions so that I can include every team, so that I'm never working with one team and more than another team. And this really keeps, it's a good hygiene sort of thing, and it also means that I learn a lot more than I might otherwise learn, because instead of just looking at the teams that I'm really familiar with, I look at all sorts of other teams and start to learn about how they're put together.
So would you mind if we unpacked just a little bit how it is you go about this? I'm guessing you have some mathematical models represented on a spreadsheet, something similar to that, and that you have various algorithms. And if I'm talking out of my ass saying words that don't exist, but correct me, but this is just the best I can get it out of my head, what I'm trying to say.
So I don't have any spreadsheets, actually. Although it's a little bit silly. I have a database, obviously, where I scrape the raw data from the NHL, and I put it into a database where I can, just so that I can ask the questions that I want to ask. And then I have a few thousand lines of Python scripts that I wrote myself over about several years. And then I put those together into visualizations, and they run, you know, mostly they run every night. You know, there's another slate of games, and then I've got stuff that generates for, you know, certain things for games, certain things for teams, things for the league. The really mathematically sophisticated stuff is the predictive stuff. Where I'm looking, where that's something where I actually created some new thing, which is trying to predict what's going to happen in the future. And that's you know, it's a very mathematical endeavor, but there's always going to be a lot more judgment and art to that than there is to just, you know, this is who played together last night in some game.
So your geek out level is strong on this stuff. Let me take it just a little bit further then, if you don't mind.
Sure.
So you're writing your code yourself.
Yeah.
Is this something you intend to do something more with? I mean, like, is this something that, well, first of all, what's your accuracy with your predictions?
So it's precisely how you measure it is actually a little bit tricky. So if you want to predict who's going to win, that's one thing. You can just write down the number of times your prediction is right versus the times your predictions are wrong. But that's not what I do. I'm trying to predict the probability that a team is going to win. So if I say a coin is, you know, like say you give me a coin and you say, you know, tell me what's going on with this coin, and I say, well, I think it's a weighted coin and it's going to flip heads 70% of the time and it's going to flip tails 30% of the time. And then you flip it and it comes up heads and you say, well, was I right or not? You know, you don't, like, right. That's what you get in terms of hockey games. Or if I say that the Senators are going to win this particular game with a probability of 90% and then they lose, am I wrong? Am I 90% wrong? So it's...
And so do you weight that with a sample size? I mean, the 10, can you kind of get a rough idea? And
yeah. That's
really what the question boils down to is, I'm curious, like, are you right more than you're wrong? Is this something that gives you inspiration to make it even better? Or are you just not even in the ballpark yet?
So there's a few ways of trying to come up with some sort of concrete answer about how, you know, am I right more than I would expect to be? One is just comparing to other people who are setting predictions for games. And the obvious example there would be betting lines. So the people at Vegas are, you know, if they say the probability is 40% and I say the probability is 50%, then there ought to be money to be made in the long run with somebody who goes with what I do. So I used to, I don't anymore because I find it very time consuming, but I used to gamble based on the stuff that I do, and I found I had a slight edge, smaller than I expected, but it was positive. So that suggests that I'm in the same ballpark as the people who are setting lines for Vegas, which feels good.
So do you do any of this outside of hockey? Are you a guy who looks at stock markets and tries to apply the same thing? Because that's a rabbit hole right there.
I've seen some people come
out the worst for it, actually.
In terms of the mathematical skill that you need to do that kind of thing, I would feel comfortable doing that, and people have asked me about it in the past. But to make a model that's worth anything, you don't just need the technical sophistication to know how to do it. You also have to know something about what it is you're modeling. So modeling hockey is not so difficult for me because I know a little bit about hockey, or much less than I would like to, but something. But I don't know anything about the stock market, and so I don't know what to expect. Like you're making these decisions constantly when you're making a new mathematical model. You're thinking to yourself, you know, what am I going to include as my past behavior that's going to predict the future behavior? And if you don't see, you know, if you don't know what to start with, then you'll just never start with anything.
So are you able to make a model that can actually learn itself? Is this something you can plug into Watson and say, here, this is what we're trying to accomplish right now? Use some of their, I guess it's AI. I don't know if it's really that yet or not, but is this something where you can teach, you can code in for this thing to kind of learn from itself or no?
So I don't myself. That's not my background. I prefer to have models where I have a tighter control about what's going on. I don't like know exactly what the 12 features are in my main, or 13 features are in my main model, and I could rattle them all off for you. You know, I won't, but these specific things, which I think are important, and I have, you know, measured coefficients for how important they've been in the past. There are neural nets, and there's some really reasonably sophisticated mathematics that are going on there that people have worked in that I don't work in myself. Part of the trouble there, though, is that there's a disconnect between just, I want to have the very best predictions, I want to be absolutely as accurate as I possibly can, and then there's the, I want to understand the thing that I'm doing better than I understand it now. And those are often in tension. So if you just want to have the best possible predictions, then there are more sophisticated algorithms than what I'm doing, which don't give you any insight into why a particular probability is the way that it is. But the approach that I'm taking is slightly less accurate, but gives you a little bit more insight as to... So I can say, for instance, you know, the predictions that I said for tonight's games are the Bruins with 65%, and here's exactly how it breaks down, this, 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 this. And so that I find that, for, as an educator, As a teacher, I find that much more satisfying.
And so one of your endpoints is definitely whether they win or lose. Are you looking at anything else? I think I saw one just specifically on Matt Duchesne in the past, too. So what other things are you putting out there on Twitter for people?
So in terms of team performances, when it comes to past performance, to predict, like, you know, I'm looking at predicting tonight's game. I don't actually look at past and lost records at all. I bake that into some predictions. Like if somebody wants to say, well, how many points are the Avs going to have at the end of the year? Then, you know, I'm going to include the points that they already have. But the predictions themselves use shot counts, or shot rates, that's the primary thing. Some measures of goalie strength and some power play and shorthanded shot measures. In fact, I find I use a fair bit less goal analysis than shot analysis. It's counterintuitive at first, you know. Shots don't count for anything on the score sheet, and goals obviously do. But the goals have a lot more luck in them than the shots do. And so especially if you only want to look at a short period of time, then you get much better predictions out of shot measures. And then looking at a short period of time is often preferable to looking at a long period of time because you get data that's closer to the team that you actually want to talk about. And we want to talk about tonight's game. You want to get as close to data with tonight's lineup as you can. And if you look back 20, 30, 60 games, all of a sudden you're talking with different team, different coach, different structure, different ideas.
So have you looked at tonight's game at all between the Blackhawks and the Avs?
Only a little bit. But
only a little.
It's curious. Of course, there's been a trade with Chicago just last night, which I assume that Scuderi is going to play for Chicago. Not tonight, he'll play soon. So I don't know how to take that into account. My models don't explicitly. So I'm curious about that.
Yeah. So now that you say that, I think I saw something talking about it. I didn't see it very clearly. I was just running in the door. But he's an older guy, isn't he?
Scuderi, yeah. He's 36 or 37. Yeah.
I mean, older for hockey, whatever. But
yeah, right. I was going to say, which is to say he's slightly older than me. He's not exactly old.
Yeah, and hockey's a fun thing that way. Some of the guys who have lasted for a long time too, I'm really curious. Like the way that you go about solving problems is it seems like you come up with really good questions, and that helps for solving a problem for sure. Because if you can't really boil down to what you want, then you're just kind of guessing anyways. And for me, unfortunately, mine is a lot of being wrong. I typically find every wrong way before I finally get a right way. But I'm really curious about how even more data would help people. Like if you could actually put sensors in the sticks, you could get some sort of ratio of power on these, or you could see how well players are shooting. Could you then turn around and improve a player's shot in a measurable way just by knowing what the measurements are? Because, you know, the eye test that you talked about, it's fun, it's nice, but you can get more precise data and data that you might be able to use so long as you have somebody who knows how to interpret that data. So do you see things like sensors making their way into the NHL and something that would improve the game, both for the fan and for people who just want to geek out on stats?
I do. I think there's two levels there. There's the sort of we're doing something wrong and we need to fix it level, and I don't know how much you're going to get out of that. You can take sensor data from sticks, for instance. Why do they smash? Like, are there particular styles where you could tell, for instance, that a stick was about to smash, and so you would switch it out right away before you waited for it to explode on an important shot. Like that kind of, you know, we're gonna get a little tiny edge with those kinds of things, I think is small, but that's gonna be there. And I think that it's more likely that you're gonna find this stuff is driven by fan engagement, where we're being able to say, oh, you know, so and so has skated 6 kilometers in this game compared to so and so who's skated 10 kilometers. I think that stuff's gonna be driving fan interest. And I think a lot of it is going to be useful for analysts as well. You'll take the same data and you'll package it up in two different ways. You'll do it one way for people who want to engage with the team at a fan level, and you'll take the same data and present it in a different way to coaches who want to know, you know, is, like, for instance, you could define some sort of notion of in position for, you know, with a clever algorithm, and then you could say, how often is this player in position? And if you had tracking data for that, you could measure that.
And there's definitely some software out there that's getting at that. I think some of it's for sale now too, and I don't know how good it is. But I mean, the same way that, you know, Facebook can recognize a face and say this is this person, I think they've got it down now where they can either just get on the number of the player on the back or just find out where that player is and keep an eye on him, but they can keep track of everyone out there and give you some really cool looking visualizations. And it's one that it doesn't seem real prominent yet, but I think that we're going to see that come out in the next year or two at least.
Yeah, that technology has been, in some sense, it's existed for almost a decade, but it's, you know, just a little bit too slow, just a little bit too computationally intensive, just a little bit too sophisticated mathematically, but people have been working on this stuff, and I think in the next few years you are going to see that kind of thing.
Oh, no, it requires an investment right now, too. I think to pull that one off, you need some cameras staged around the arena pointing straight down. So you need, you know, the buy-in of the team, too. This isn't something that somebody can just set up from the press box and report on it later. But right, I think all that's going to start to work itself out, too.
Yeah, and you need not just a handful of clever people. You need a whole infrastructure. And so to build that infrastructure, you need somebody to take a leadership role. You know, maybe it's a team that says we're going to make this a deal. Maybe it's an arena. Maybe it's the league itself. You know, that's the kind of, you know, it's not just technological change. That's, in a small sense, that's a political change.
Your behavior change, too. And, you know, in hockey, behavior change is scary. People don't like change.
In math, people used to joke that that the field progresses with every funeral. And it's a little grim, but it might be, there might be a similar effect where old habits die very, very hard. In places, especially in places that are so, you know, old white men dominated like hockey.
Yeah, well, I don't know what it's like in the mathematics world, but there's plenty of disciplines where your work is basically the papers that you put out in the journals and to your peers, and that is what you base your entire career on and your funding and the people who pay for what you do. It becomes difficult to contradict yourself or to have any caveats at all. And so I think a lot of guys don't want to change. And for me, right away, I'm thinking about Ansel Keys and the whole saturated fat thing that, you know, most of the world still believes it out there, but even the government's come out and said, no, that's just, it's not accurate. It's wrong. And it's really hard to do that in big fields, especially if you are receiving funding.
Oh yeah. And that's one of the struggles that I have that is not being able to make enough money because I'm supported by the public. I mean, it's definitely difficult, but one of the joys there is that I can just, you know, I can just say what I want. And if I'm wrong, then I'm just wrong. There's no particular consequence. I don't have somebody calling me up and saying, no, you're making us all look bad.
Yeah, and it's not like this huge people or a group of people that you're dealing with either. You can be agile as one person. That's why small teams are so much better in every startup that's ever made it. They're usually better when they're small. Once they become very official and corporate, that's where things kind of go badly, at least I think, though. So you're in a spot where you can pivot whenever you need to. You can say, nope, wrong path here, but you know what, I'm onto something. Let's go this direction and see what comes of it.
Sure, and that's one of the things that makes Twitter incredibly handy for me as a professional tool, in addition to just being really great fun, is that if I come up with stuff, you know, and I put it out and I immediately get feedback that says, this is stupid, why are you doing this? And if then I can't convince people with my explanations, then I can just say, well, you know, maybe it is stupid and I'll just go do something else.
Yeah, and for me, Twitter is the best A-B test ever. I mean, you can put stuff out there and you can get your feedback in a big hurry and people let you know if they love things or not. I do it with almost all the shirts that I put out on AppsFam.
Right.
And a lot of what I get back from people, you know, goes into it. And I think that for the most part, the people I deal with, they're all pretty nice. But I imagine that you get a little bit of trolling from people, especially people who consider themselves to be smart and to know more than you. Is that pretty accurate?
Oh, yeah. And lots of people do know more than me.
I'm not trying to beat you up there as like a guy who can talk to you, but, you know, just the idea that there's a lot of people out there who are looking to improve their self-worth and their self-image by putting other people down, and Twitter is the best place because it's anonymous, right? Nobody has to know who you are, so you can just go around crapping on anyone you want.
Yeah, I mean, I get a bit of that, and I'm not especially thick-skinned. I mean, I should be, but I'm not. And so some of that stuff does get to you, but then at the end of the day, you try to remind yourself that you're making something and they're not.
Yeah, and you can also turn things off, too. That's one thing I've had to teach myself.
Yeah.
And, so I think it was Steve Jobs, his favorite quote. He has many that I like. I am an Apple fanboy, just in case you need to know. But one of my favorite quotes from him is that real artists ship. And to me, it took me a while to figure that out. But I've gotten to the point where I don't obsess on things being perfect anymore. I'd much rather get things out there more consistently and then follow up on them if I really need to. But for the most part, I don't need to. I mean, I'm not doing things that are so particular like you are. Mine are much more opinions or little shows on the podcast or talking to people like you. Sure. So I found that it's even better to get more things out there in the world, because if nobody knows it exists, then it's really not worth much at all, is it?
Yeah, that's very, very good advice.
And so would you be happy doing this if you weren't getting feedback from people?
I think if I wasn't getting any kind of feedback, it would be extremely difficult.
That's very real of you. I thought you were going to tell me, no, I would do this anyways by myself.
No, it's surprisingly, I mean, every like every job has an emotional component, and everybody wants to feel like they're making a difference of one kind or another. And making pretty pictures about hockey is maybe not the most, you know, world-changing thing, but I find that there's a lot of people who find that the common bond of understanding things through sports is really valuable to them, and I find their feedback extremely valuable to me. It's almost reached the point. I remember asking just talking to a handful of other people about jobs, and a hairdresser friend of mine who said that her job was basically the best she could think of because all of her friends came to see her at work every day.
And that is pretty cool.
And which I never thought to put it that way, but especially for a job that I personally would find extremely unpleasant. But I'm finding this thing is true, you know, now that I have a community of people who support me, who pay attention to my work. You know, and some of them are really nerdy, and some of them are really silly, and some of them are all sorts of other stuff. But that community aspect is really important for me.
And it's fascinating too, just to have the interactions, especially if you care about things like that. If you're a people watcher, like when I go to the airport, my favorite thing is just to watch people and try to figure out, you know, every 16 seconds she fixes her glasses, looks over to see if the guy's looking at her, things like that. It's fascinating to me how people work and their behaviors and the sociology and psychology around it.
Sure. And I think of hockey as a social science, which might not be strictly correct. And I'm not a social scientist by training, but I'm interested in almost anything. And so that makes it a fun and interesting thing to analyze. For instance, I was on a podcast the other week, and one of the things that came up is how do you reconcile the role that we ask athletes to play, where, you know, on one hand we analyze all of their movements, possibly with chips literally embedded under them. There's not many of the rest of us who have to go to work and have chips put on our body that measure literally everything we do.
Right.
And so we analyze that mathematically, but then we also, you know, we lionize athletes who do great stuff, like, I mean, Evander Kane sent that heartfelt message to one of his fans who was going through a hospitalization recently, which is, you know, and everybody says, oh, that's so touching. But that's the kind of stuff we expect hockey players to do, to, you know, to donate their money to charitable causes, to glad hand with people, to talk to reporters, to, you know, all this extra stuff, which, you know, which just isn't part of how they win or lose.
And while you're at it, be a role model to my child, that sort of thing.
Yeah, right. And that's, like, it's not, I mean, it's not meant to be like, oh, life is hard for athletes. After all, we give them also great, great deals of money. But just that it's, as a fan, as somebody who's interested in this crap of society, it's a very subtle and complicated thing. And that means that there's essentially endless things to be interested about, even if you don't want to just look at mathematical stats all day long.
So I'm going to jump sports on you really quick to talk about this, but I've found that, so there's a lot of people in the UFC who train here in Colorado, and a lot of them actually within about, I don't know, a mile of where I'm at. Right. And my kids are in jiu-jitsu, and I grew up in martial arts and all that, and I've talked to quite a few of them. Some of them have been world champions. They say the hardest part is you can never take a day off. If you're right. Not training, you think the other guy's training harder than you. So there's the physical side of it and the mental there, but at the same time, you can't go to the local natural grocers or Whole Foods or whatever and pick up lunch because everyone knows who the hell you are all of a sudden. And like, right. Ronda Rousey is like an extreme example, but I have to think for hockey players, especially when they get to Canada or places that are a little bit crazier with their hockey, that it becomes overwhelming, that you do almost fall into a depression because you're surrounded by so much attention. It sounds weird and contradictory, I think, but I think you probably know what I'm talking about, that you fail to become yourself because you can't reflect on just who you are, what you've done. It's constant in your face. And when you get away, you're hiding, basically.
Yeah. And it's funny, if you have no attention, then you suffer that way. And if you have constant attention, you suffer there too. I mean, it's a basic human need, but once you get too much of it, it's very detrimental.
And when I asked you about the lottery, if you won that, what would you do with your time and all that? The reason I asked that is because you can get a real feel for where people are. Like, people think if they won the lottery, therefore they'd be happier. And I don't think that's the truth. I think that money magnifies your situation. Maybe right away you'd be happier. Maybe you'd love your new Tesla or whatever car you wanted to get. But at the end of the day, you're either a content, happy person who knows, you know, how to get through a day and be happy about it, or you're not. And eventually that money is just going to magnify one way or the other.
Yeah. And so I guess the only real difference there is, you know, like, if you literally don't have enough money, then,
right,
you know, then it's crippling.
Well, there's a certain threshold, right? So, I mean, for me in particular, working my way up, most of my real life is in the corporate arena, making movies for corporate America, basically. But what I found is there's a certain threshold that, you know, you're not making enough. You're constantly struggling to get by. And once you can get to that sort of thrive stage where now you have enough money to do things, it becomes much easier and you move more freely. It's like a hockey player gripping his stick too hard because he hasn't scored in a while.
Yeah.
Once you start to have that base, you can actually, I think you get way better. I think you reach a flow state that you can't otherwise, but I agree. I still think though that people, they look at things like celebrity and money as a way to be happier. And I think that especially for hockey players, they find that it's not true.
No, I agree.
I mean, I'd love to be rich. Give me that problem, but...
It's not very easy to, you know, however empathetic you imagine yourself to be, it's not very easy to imagine what other people's problems are like.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm trying to be better about that too. I think that it's really easy to sit on this side and watch a game go, come on, you're killing me, Gannon. So while we're bringing this up, I'm going to go back to hockey a little bit more. We've been geeking out on science and things like that, but who are the teams that you follow? Who are you most a fan of? I'm guessing you don't have to be a huge fan of Colorado. I'm not sure. I
watch
from Halifax, I think. So I don't know what that makes you.
So Halifax is pretty much even parts Toronto, Montreal, and Boston. Mm-hmm. Naturally, I grew up as an Ottawa fan. For reasons that I don't really remember.
Okay.
But my dad and I have been Ottawa fans together for a long time. I've always had a slightly broad taste. I follow a handful of other teams. I'm also very fond of Vancouver and Winnipeg. But these days, the more that I've turned hockey into a career, the more I find I pay attention to all 30 teams. You know, West Coast teams are more difficult because I'm on the East Coast and you know, people get tired and got to go to bed. It sounds stupid, but it's true.
And how do you watch your hockey?
On TV.
Okay, so you have just cable, or you have like the NHL package or hockey streams or something?
Yeah, I have a handful of these. I have almost all of my entertainment spending is hockey.
Me as well. I don't have cable, but I have hockey streams, and that's the only reason I would have cable is to watch hockey games.
Well, it's pretty much, I mean, once you start watching, not just, you know, oh, I'm going to watch my teams, but you start watching like as much hockey as you can, which for me professionally is very important. It's funny, there's this trope, of course, that bloggers and nerds don't watch the games, but of course, you know, most of the people whose work I really respect statistically are watching just frightening amounts of hockey. And part of why is that your ideas, I mean, your statistical analysis is one thing, but the ideas that you have in the first that go into your statistical models will be bad unless you have a real understanding of what's going on. Every time you have a question, you're never going to be able to come up with an answer unless you have some sort of idea of where to look and that idea comes from.
It's all interpretation, right? I mean, this is just all people telling you what they see in the data, what they see in the game itself. I mean, I don't know that it is just a right answer. I think some people just see it better, and then they can articulate that to the rest of the people better. And that's kind of what I like about you. I have to be honest with you. I don't understand everything you put out. Some of it, I'm just like, I don't know. It looks maybe like a bell curve, maybe. And no, I'm just talking out of my butt there, too.
Well, it's... I mean, the other thing, too, is that people assume that I understand everything I put out in the same way, but everything is relative there too. Like, there's some things that you put out and you think, well, okay, this is like I'll take some data and I'll make a plot of a particular thing, you know, and I know that the plot is interesting because of some past result. And sometimes I'll say, well, the story here is clearly this that, where I use my you know, what little statistical knowledge I have as well as what little hockey knowledge I have to try and say this is my analysis of this. And other times I'll take a piece of data and I'll say, I don't know what's important here, especially when it comes to, you know, to players I don't know. And the stuff that I do is almost entirely results driven. Like, even if they're not the result that you're immediately interested in. So, you know, shots, for instance, are a result. Like, that's what happened. That's what you accomplished or failed to accomplish. But it doesn't tell you, you know, why not. So a lot of the time I would love to sit down with a coach and say, look, this is what I've measured. You know, can you tell me why this person has these results?
Like, I would love to sit down with you and a coach and hear that. That's exactly what I'd be interested in, actually.
And so you can have guesses. You can say, well, I think the reason why the Senators have this particular problem is because these particular players can't orchestrate a breakout, you know, or these particular, you know, why this particular deployment isn't working for these particular players is because, you know, this guy's getting burned on faceoffs and this person can't pinch properly, you know, or conversely, you'd say, well, these people are getting tremendous results like this because this person comes to the neutral zone with speed, which they get in this way. And like, those details of how you accomplish the results that are measured are much trickier and much more interesting. But in some sense, for hockey, we're not there yet, really. we don't even have a broad agreement about, you know, that certain results are good and should be chased, and other results are bad and should be avoided.
Like, I want to get to where everything is measured. I know that's probably geeky of me, but I want to know that a guy who's starting a rush, he's really good so long as the passes are under 25 feet. Anything past that, his accuracy goes down considerably. Like, I just think that would be so valuable if you could take that as a coach, work with this guy and go, look, here's the problem. Here's our sweet spots. This is where I want you going for right now. And then work on those longer passes. But I feel like the NHL should have more stats. I know that's going to sound ridiculous, and I'll get some hate for sure, but man, I would just love to have constant data that way, but I don't know if anybody can really parse it in a usable way, in a timely way anymore.
I think it's going to happen no matter what. Like that All-Star game stuff we had last year with the chip tracking and the, like, that's, you know, I mean, that's just demo stuff, but they're demoing that for a reason. They're going to bring that in at some point. And there's going to be, even now, there's a huge deluge. There's all sorts of people who track stats that don't mean anything, that don't tell you anything. And statistical discipline with the existing data that we've got is pretty weak. And a lot of the arguments go on about, you know, well, you can measure this number is bigger than that number. And so does that tell you that, you know, that player is better than another player? Like, how sure can you be of that? And one of the things that makes statistics, you know, a real discipline and not just here's a bunch of numbers is that you can quantify how certain you are about things. Say, well, you know, I'm 95% sure that Crosby is a better player than everybody else in the game, but I'm only, you know, 20% sure that some other player is better than these other people. Like, and even that's heavily simplified for podcast purposes, but every time you have two specific things, you compare them, you can't just say, you know, this is better. You should say, like you're saying, you should quantify everything. You know, how much better? How certain are you that it's better? You know, and you constantly contextualize this way, and that leads to much better understanding. So there's going to be a process when the new stats come out. You know, first you're going to have this wash of data, and you're going to say, well, you know, this person is the 350th in the league at this particular thing. And then you're going to need to have the context to say, okay, well, how bad is that? And that's, you know, there's an extra level to stats all the time that way.
And then there's always going to be, but for some reason he had a month that was just on everything went his way. But
right. And then you the other thing there about interpreting results is you want to say, how unlikely is that? Okay, so-and-so just had a point streak of a particular length. You know, how much of a big deal is that? How unusual is that? And one of the things that I've been finding recently is that a lot of players get maligned for supposedly streaky scoring results. And then when you analyze the games in which their goals fall, you see a pattern which shows that their underlying talent is almost certainly constant all the time. The nature of random processes is that you get some things in clumps in certain places, and then you get troughs and dry spells where people go cold for a while. And so that's one of the things where statistics can also, instead of augmenting the conversation, really tap down the conversation a little bit, where you say, you know, there's actually nothing here to talk about. This is just, you know, some things go up, things go down, they just move around. But there's really nothing to worry about.
So are you a gamer at all? Do you play video games of any sort?
A little bit.
I think that this is really interesting, the way that they find what's important. They find the metrics of success for people in a game. And I'm thinking in particular about the NHL hockey game from EA Sports.
Mm-hmm.
If you play in the GM mode, I mean, for me, it's a lot of trial and error. But what I'm finding is that there are certain players that when they play together, their chemistry, the things they do together make them all better. And I'm wondering if it's not going to be like that for teams, if they understand that, you know, between our entire team, our top six guys, we get exactly 5 takeaways a game or something like that, whereas we know we're going to need at least 10 to play this style. Like, can you start to put together these different pictures, even if they're a bit blurry at the time, of what basic things you would need within a team? And then can you kind of go and pick players based on that? And when I say can you, is it something that you think would ever really happen, or is this always going to be an ex-player who's now a scout for some team who goes and travels with them and watches and go gut feeling is we want that guy in the draft?
I think there's already a place for that kind of, you know, we would like a player that fits this particular profile, and then you can do statistical similarity tests, and that will tell you actually, you know, so and so who you might not have thought this way does actually play this way, and that's one of the things which can be helpful as a simplifying thing, but which can also throw you off is these narratives that get established about people that oh, he's, you know, he's a sniper, and so that's his thing, and you look into his numbers and you say, well, actually his shooting percentage is only a little bit higher than you think. But but he's extremely good at some other skill, which is related to sniping. And so you say, okay, you know, maybe the bead we had on this player is not quite right, but his name might never get brought up in trade talks or free agency targeting talks because, you know, because they have, there's this image of him as a particular kind of player.
Right.
And sometimes these can be just in complete defiance of the facts. Like, for instance, this idea that Kessel doesn't skate very fast is extremely common, even though his measured foot speed is incredible. It's like just the narratives that take hold can sometimes be perfectly opposed to reality, and yet they're still very common. Sometimes the narratives are perfectly true, and their
opinions are easily heard, though, right? I mean, it takes one time of a guy being clutch in the playoffs to go, he's clutch, even though he might have been the next six seasons, you know?
Yeah, and you get all the usual cognitive biases that people have studied all come into play really fast, where you see a guy be incredible for a little while, and then you imagine that that's how he ought to be all the time, and you're this is part of why skilled players don't get quite the reputation that they deserve, and instead get maligned often, is because there's this idea that you ought to be able to put out at a particular level all the time. The skill players are going to have flashes of things which are amazing, and then when they don't play like that all the time, they'll say, well, why? You must not be working 100%. You must not be really trying hard. You must not be doing the right things.
I think a lot of people see it like you would a truck. Like, this is the horsepower this truck comes with, and if you ever get less than that, then, things are wrong. Where, I mean, like Landeskog on our team, he's actually not having a bad season, but when you watch the games, or at least from what I expect of him, I'm a little let down. It seems lackluster. But then I go and look at the stats. I'm like, well, he's right up there, actually. He's doing great. And I'm not really even sure where that comes from, but there's, again, some sociology in there and some psychology as well. But I wonder, I don't know. I really feel like the stats are something where it's not going to take over the game, and it's not really going to remove jobs from people who go out there and scout or coach or whatever they do. I really think it's going to enhance things, and it's going to happen either way. I mean, hockey's not immune from innovation and technology. And I think that, like music, like publishing, eventually there's going to be sort of this disruption within the league that everybody's going to recover from. And then just like overnight, we're going to suddenly have just a plethora of data.
Yeah, and you'll have, I mean, decision makers are still going to be the ones making decisions. And they'll do it with better data that they understand better instead of bad data that they understand badly. But the ability of a general manager to make a decision, that's still going to be the deciding crucial factor that makes, GMs good GMs or bad GMs.
But so I'm sorry, go ahead.
I mean, they'll just do it with more sophisticated data that's a little bit closer to what they can do, like to what can be projected into the future. And that hopefully will lead to a league that I think that's not just more fun, but also more competitive.
Yeah, I mean, these are the best of the best of the best in the world, right? I mean, the NHL is... it's the place you want to play no matter where you grew up, where you live. It's as good as it gets. So this is such a small sampling of the hockey players out there too, that I hope that the data goes out into the minor leagues and things like that too. And I think that certain parts of it will. The stuff that costs a lot of money probably won't. Believe it or not, these minor league guys don't actually get paid a lot of money, and their teams don't have a lot of money to share, even though we have stars like Randon, who's down there right now, who's absolutely going to be an NHL star. But it's, I don't know. I think it's going to be a huge thing for hockey, and I'm not nearly as afraid of it as other people seem to be.
It can be presented in a way that's quite threatening. Twitter is especially bad for this. There's a definite, like, I know what's best for my team, especially, and and any even the slightest variance from what I consider to be the best lines, the best trades, the best waiver picks, etc., is clearly evidence that the GM and all who surround him are fools. And people can be very, very hasty that way. And especially because you don't, it's very easy to say, well, I prefer this player for this reason and these lines for those reasons, but you don't know the constraints that people are operating under. I mean, the decision-making process is always going to be more complicated than just, here's the stats, here's the measurements, here's the projections for particular players.
Yeah, and as fans, there's plenty of things we don't know as well. Like, sometimes we don't know a guy's been playing hurt for a month, or this guy has a problem with this condition when he's at certain altitude. There's so much more that goes into it. But as a fan, it's easy to be fanatical, right? That's the fun of it. That's why we pay our money and
walk. Yeah, and so there's two levels to it. On the one hand, I'm very indulgent of fans being fanish. I mean, that's like, on a sociological level, that's perfectly normal, and I really enjoy it. I enjoy doing it myself, and I enjoy when other people do it, and I try not to, you know, to say, oh, you know, oh, you're being a bad fan or you're being a good fan. But
right.
But being it, like, so if you want to be a fan and say, well, I think the GM is making a hysterically bad decision, that's one thing. But if you want to be a GM and make a better decision, then you have to operate under a different set of, you know, now you have to actually take that stuff into account.
Yep. And I imagine the pressure is real. I don't think these guys take it lightly. I don't think psychics, yeah, I had a great career and I'll just dabble in this really quick. I look at him, I see a face of a guy who served, you know, served at least one term as a president. He seems like he's really aging in accelerated fashion. And I know there's a lot of pressure involved with this. So I got a lot of respect for all of them. I mean, really, I'm a hockey fan first, then I'm an Avs fan. But for me, I just, there's a lot of respect for what actually happens in the league. And I've learned a little bit more from podcasts like this, that there's this whole ecosphere of people that, you know, the hockey world wouldn't turn the way it does without these people collecting stats. There's a lady we had on named Jessica Canales, I think, who her job is to collect stats, kind of interpret them quickly, get them off to Jeremy Roenick so that he can speak about them on TV. And there's all these areas people don't know about that just fascinate me. I like the underbellies.
Yeah. Well, there's always every little facet of humanity, there's more to it the more you look at it.
I agree. So let me ask you this. You might have said this already, just the things we talked about, but what sort of things do you believe in strongly that others just disagree with thoroughly? Just among friends, even if you were with five friends at the bar and you said something, while you believe in it strongly, these guys would be like, whatever, man.
So probably the most obvious one is that I really like to present data visually. I'm extremely keen on visually taking on information. And a lot of that is just my own personal preference. I understand things better when they're presented visually. But I get a lot of flack from people for being overambitious. Somebody called my visualizations horrifying and deranged the other day.
Wow.
A bit hyperbolic. But there's a certain backlash of people who don't exactly dislike stats, but they viscerally dislike seeing things presented visually.
Right, it just doesn't vibe with them. Not their jam, I guess.
Right, they want... I mean, some people really prefer numbers. Some people take in information from tables. Some people... there's definitely something that's a little bit more immediate there, where, you know, if you look at some thing and there's all sorts of lines and colors and different elements and, you know, you haven't done like that before, it's very understandable that some people just go, oh, no, I don't like that. And some people aren't interested or willing to get past that. And in some sense, there's an impasse there with me and other people. Like, if you don't want to take in information that way, then you're never going to be friends. It's sort of,
yeah.
Since the whole deal is doing things this way. So I try to, on the one hand, I can be defensive like anybody else about my work, but I also just try to say, like from a teaching background where I come from, I just say, well, you learn in a different way than I am teaching. And so, you know, so there's not going to be a connection here, and that's okay. And you can just learn from other people.
It's cool you to think that way, because you would have hated me as I was a horrible student, but I have this, it's a curse or a blessing or what, but if I'm not really interested, I just can't engage to the level that I need to get any great value out of a teaching. So I'm a guy who is just mesmerized by things like Hans Zimmer, I think, did this great TED talk where he shows data we had never seen before. And it's really just a Google tool where he shows it over time. So it goes by the year and these bubbles float around the screen showing you where population exists and where it doesn't and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And to me,
it's amazing.
That was a game changer for me. I mean, I didn't really care about much of that before, but once I saw that, I started thinking how I could bring that into my world, and that's where I exist. It's much more creative, whereas the math side, it just seems so complicated to me. That's why I have a great appreciation for what you do, because I feel like if the world stopped right now and it was my job to figure things out like you do to save the world, we would just call it quits right
there. It's flattering. Complexity too is one of those things that frustrates people, and there's a difference between complexity and unfamiliarity. So if you want to add extra things that need to be considered, then you have to find a way to present that in a way which doesn't appear frightening. So that's I mean, the daily challenge for me is how to get more information into things in a way that's easier to digest, in the sense that it answers people's questions. And so the real key there is less about graphical techniques and more about presenting things to people that answer questions that they're interested in.
Right. I mean, once you can get them to actually, you know, ask the question and ask a good question, I think that's where people really buy into. But you put out things I don't even know I want to know sometimes. So I'm going to be looking to see what you put out. But
So that's primary, like, for in terms of coming up with new stuff, easily my main driver is conversations on Twitter, sometimes that I'm having and sometimes that I just watch, where people say, oh, well, what about this thing? And I think, you know, how could I look at that piece of data in a way that would answer that question? You know, and then I think to myself, okay, now how can I make the same thing for all 30 teams? And those two, if you do those two things together, you almost always come up with something that's worth investing some time into.
And then you're like, how could I explain this to Cam? And then if you do that, you've got it.
I don't know what the word is, but I have a mental list of people in my head of who range the all the way from extremely sophisticated mathematically to, you know, only barely interested in reading graphs. And I like to, who are fans of various teams, and I test drive stuff on all sorts of people. And so, you know, if, especially because some people enjoy figuring out a new visualization, they think it's like a puzzle. They have the opposite approach to the people. They, oh, you know, this is horrific when they look at something wild and strange with lots of colors. And so if I can get a positive response from somebody like that, as well as a positive response from somebody who wants, you know, they want a takeaway of one piece of information, they don't mind anything else. That's, you know, that's when I know I've got something that's good. And instead, if I get, oh, you know, oh, I wish it had this other thing, I wish it had this, I wish it had this, you know, then I go back to the drawing board.
So I would love to see you actually presenting a graph then, something where you're talking about it, but you're pointing at it and you're, you know, showing what this quadrant does versus that, or where this is in relation to something else. That's something I think would be huge.
There are videos of so I've spoken twice at two hockey analytics conferences in the last year, the one in Washington, D.C. And one in Rochester. And there are slides on my website and links to videos that the conference organizers took. So you can see me dancing around, yelling and pointing at stuff. I'm a very energetic, slightly silly speaker.
That's awesome, actually. I'm going to put that in the show notes so everybody can check that out. But yeah, that's exactly what I'm talking about right there. I think there's something to be said for combining the duality of the audio and then the visual and then, you know, pointing at things. And
I love teaching this way, but I hate learning this way. I much prefer to read things and some good pictures when I'm trying to learn things and not have somebody talk at me.
Yeah, that's weird. I think that's me, though. I'm almost certain that if I were properly diagnosed, I would be diagnosed with dyslexia at some point. I think that had a lot to do with the way I learned, but you know what? You get superpowers, too, from the things that give you challenges. That's usually where the biggest opportunities are, so I'm better for it in many ways.
Well, all the challenges that you get in terms of learning are all, if you have the right kind of attitude as a teacher, you can always turn them into some kind of engagement with students.
So how did you end up teaching? Is this something you wanted to do, or is this that pivot we talked about where you were going this direction and went, I kind of like this actually?
No, teaching is probably the one really constant feature of my entire professional life. I've wanted to teach from the time that I was 18 or so, and so I taught mathematics because it's considered par for the course for all mathematicians to teach. It's one of the really rewarding things about academia is that everyone is expected to be able to teach at least their specific subject matter. And I have a real passion for that, and I still teach part-time as well. So when I'm not literally on Twitter talking to people about hockey, I'm generally doing lesson preparation or actually teaching physics and computing sometimes, but mostly mathematics.
I just can't imagine a scenario where you actually get paid properly for what you do then, because that is so much prep work, and there's so many different types of people you have to teach. And my understanding is teachers don't make a lot at any level.
No, not that much. Although in terms of prep work, it's not bad. The problem is not the hourly rate. The problem is finding enough work. But it's not a bad job, especially when you do it for a little while. You get better and better at it, and it's amazing how similar the number of people who try to learn calculus at 18 are. They have the same sorts of problems, and you get to anticipate, you know, the methods in which they make mistakes. And so once you do it for a little while, it can get much, much easier. It's really like any other career that way.
Yeah, I mean, in humans, they are pattern recognition machines. So that's really interesting that you're at an angle or at a certain perspective on that, where you can see people come in and the consistencies and age and how they struggle and how they get over it.
Well, that's
got to make you a better teacher for sure.
Well, and that pattern recognition machine, that's another way to say mathematician, really. That's what I think of mathematics as being able to recognize patterns. And people are are doing that when they're watching hockey too all the time.
Yeah, they can't help but do it, right? I mean, it's not quite as simple as you look in the cloud and you see a dragon or a face or whatever. But yeah, after a while, you start to have a skill of knowing, you know, that they're not in the box, or this 1-3-1 they're doing isn't going to work because this guy's way out of his place. You can just kind of see those patterns in real time when you start to get good at looking for them. But sometimes you need people to tell you what it is and how to look for it.
Oh, yeah. And the problem is not the ability to detect patterns. The problem is that humans are so good and so wired to detect patterns that they'll detect patterns that aren't really there.
And right. So you said previously you were talking about pinching in, and this is, I've talked about this like three times, but it really just had an impact on me, where another guy I was talking to, AJ Hayfley, he was talking to somebody in the press box. It was like somebody really famous, I forget who, but the guy basically, they saw the same play. This Nick Holden went to pinch, got beat, they went down, they scored. As AJ was kind of, you know, exclaiming about it, this guy was explaining to him that what really happened there isn't so much that Nick Holden did that, is that he didn't have the support of the guys around him. So everyone without the puck, they didn't play the way they should have to feel comfortable and to be able to take that risk of going down there and doing that. And that's one of those things where, you know, I wasn't looking for patterns like that before, but now every game that I watch, I'm starting to look like, is he going to pinch? If so, where is everyone at that stage? I haven't taken it any further, but I'm now to where I recognize it. And it makes the game so much more enjoyable when you can start to find things like that to give you insight.
Yep. And that's that, as a fan, for me personally, a lot of the reward is being able to look at things at a different level and try to look for different patterns.
So you're a fan, you're a mathematician, you're a teacher and all that. If you could place a billboard where there's plenty of visibility, where everyone could see it and you could just say whatever you wanted to them, what would it say? And it doesn't have to be hockey related. Just you get this chance to say these things to these people. And it can be me if you want to. I won't hold any judgment against you.
Eat more pictures. It's funny. I have never considered, you know, that kind of mass advertising is, I don't know if I would ever get anything I wanted to get across that way.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be like for hockey biz or anything either. It could just be like a big sign that says, be cool. Or,
I would be tempted to just put up a solid color. Just, you know, no words, no nothing. Just, you know, just all big thing in gold or white.
I like it. Like Christmas, it's very abstract of you.
I am by nature extremely abstract.
That's funny. Okay, so where do you get your news from, though? I meant to ask you this earlier when you were talking about it, but you were saying, like, you scrape your data, I guess, from the NHL or whatever database holds that, some sort of place, but where do you actually get your hockey news from? Or are you a hockey news kind of guy?
Yeah, Twitter. Almost entirely Twitter.
And like, any accounts that you would tell people to follow? If you had to pick, like, three guys, these are the guys that I follow because, in my opinion, they're vetted gurus.
Well, So there's a handful of people I really look up to for specific things. There's one account of a chap who goes by DataRink, and that's his Twitter handle, @DataRink, who has a commitment to minimalism in data visualization that I find extraordinary. And he clearly learned a lot of what he knows from Edward Tufte, who's not a hockey person at all, who's a data viz nerd. In terms of hockey news, I'm of a very broad mentality. I follow hundreds and hundreds of people, and I don't pay any particular attention to, you know, one or two people. I really like having the broad diversity of opinions there. And so that's what I would do, is I would, you know, really just find rafts and rafts of people, and you can, without too much trouble, you can get communities of people who are really strong, and that means that it's very unlikely that you'll miss any particular thing, you know. You rely on a particular person, and then they have to go to the hospital, God forbid, and then all of a sudden you're bereft of news. But if you follow these large nets of people, then almost everything comes through one way or another.
Crowdsource your news that way. I like it, actually. And it's another, you know, great, great feature of Twitter, that it's instant, and you can hit these veins of people, and it's, you know, you're good about hitting that unfollow button too. You can weed out the stuff that isn't important to you, and you start to get a consensus. I agree. I'm still looking for a guy that, like, one guy who I can trust on trade stuff, because when it comes time to talk trades in hockey, it just, the whole world explodes, and you get so much, you're like, I don't even know anymore. Like, I didn't even know that team existed.
Yeah.
And that's not true. I know all the teams, but I was being dramatic. But anyways, you know, it's just like, I would like just one guy who I can vet him, say, you're my digital guru on this. I'm going to you for everything until you prove me wrong.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure the only way you can do this is if you have a high tolerance for being let down.
Right. Or if you don't expect too much, you never get let down, I suppose. But I don't know, man. I have to say more and more, I don't look at the news. I don't do any of that. Everything I get is Twitter. And I think it's fascinating because not only can I find people out there who know what they're talking about, but I can get them on a podcast and ask them silly questions. Thanks for being that guy, by the way.
No problem.
All right, a couple more rapid fire ones, and then I will let you get on with your day. We got Patrick Kane coming into town tonight, and a lot of buzz around him right now. Do you think he's the best player in the league? And if not, then who do you think is?
No, I mean, he's an excellent winger, but I don't think he's the best player in the league by some distance. I personally go with Crosby, with the possibility of somebody like Erik Karlsson. I think one of the tests there is if you ask a level-headed fan if they would do a one-for-one trade of a particular player. You know, there are plenty of players I think you would, you know, plenty of teams who would fully trade Patrick Kane. But I also find it's especially right up at the very top, I find it's increasingly unhelpful to try to distinguish the very best players. Like just those three players that we talked about in that last sentence, Patrick Kane, Sidney Crosby, and Erik Karlsson, they have three almost completely different skill sets. And the idea that if you had one of them and then you got rid of them and you traded for one of the other ones, say, in fantasy world, you would, you know, no matter how great those three players are, getting rid of the other one would immediately create a hole in your roster that you would have to do something about.
Right. I thought right away you were going to ask me to define the greatest player, so I'm glad you explored this a little bit.
Yeah, so like, you know, there's... I mean, not only is it a team game in practice, but it's a team game in pieces. I think there's an overemphasis in the old-fashioned community about specific roles that, you know, that have to be played. Like, you know, your centers have to do this, and your third-pairing defenders have to do that. And I think that can be heavily overblown. But you have all the skills that you need to combine. You need people who are good at transition passes. You need people who are good at winning breakouts. You need people who can shoot. You need people who can save the puck. Like all those specific roles, and so single greatest players, I think, are never gonna be easy to compare.
And like we talked about too, there's a whole different list of skills that happen off the ice, right? Like, do you have a guy who can be a leader in the locker room? Do you have a guy who can calm people down when they need to be, or is poison right. or fire, or a guy who can take extreme accountability even when it's not his own off of somebody else or the better player? So yeah, there's so many different ways to define that, but. I don't know, I was curious to see who would jump to your mind right away. So if you had to just then, if I said to you, you know, who's successful, who's the first person that comes to your mind?
Who's successful?
Yeah, when I say success in the NHL, who's the first player that comes to mind, or coach or mascot, well, whatever you're into?
Probably Ovechkin comes to mind in terms of success. He hasn't won a Stanley Cup, but in terms of personal success, there's a perfectly good argument to be made that he's the best scorer to ever play. And like in terms of being incredibly good at one or two obviously recognizable skills, I don't think there's a great deal of argument there. You know, although some people do. The Crosby also comes to mind. It's actually one of the fun things about doing statistical work is you learn quickly who, you know, which players look good from a particular angle and which players look good from every angle. And Crosby is one of the in the latter category, where he's constantly, you know, oh, is he good at this? He's incredibly good at that. Oh, is he good at this? Yes, he's also incredibly good at that. I mean, every single way you look at his numbers are amazing, and then frequently off the charts amazing.
Right, except for right now. He's one guy, it's another thing that fascinates me, is he's not allowed to just survive. Like, people don't see that as a skill. So he hasn't played his best hockey so far this season, right?
No, it's not been that.
When he's not thriving, people are ready to throw him under that damn bus. They're like, God, what happened to him? He's done. He's over.
Yeah, so that's another thing a discipline that I try to cultivate in myself is to try not to look at short-term stuff too much. So, for instance, in my goalie models, in the goalie parts of my predictive models, I use lifetime save percentage. And this is probably not, is the simplest thing that I think is defensible, lifetime 5-on-5 save percentage. There's plenty of people doing lots of really good work in really sophisticated goalie stats for evaluating goalie play. But one of the things that, no matter how good your evaluation is, what we observe is drastically different performance from goalies from day to day. And we still haven't really made peace with that's the nature of the position. And I think the same thing is true about about scorers. You know, you look at people who go through slumps of, you know, let's just say 10 games where you only get 1 or 2 points. Is a reasonably straightforward statistical calculation to say that even if you're talking about a guy who's a point a game player, you know, you're going to have, almost certainly going to have, at least one stretch of 10 games where he gets only 1 or 2 points every year. And so, when that happens, the good scorers like Ovechkin or Crosby, you know, the articles come out right away. Oh, what's happened to Crosby? What's happened to Ovechkin? Blah, blah, blah. And no one ever says, you know, this is, well, I mean, people do, but no one with a real platform ever says this is exactly what we should expect. No, if you see it 4 times, 5 times, 6 times, then all of a sudden, yeah, that's a totally.
And maybe when, you know, that happens in the future with more information and data, maybe people go, okay, well, he's going through a slump, but let's see how he does with, if you take all the scoring off, what are the other stats that he excels at, or I don't know.
Yeah, and you do try and look at that. Like, for instance, when you're evaluating power plays, I find it's much better, instead of looking at their conversion rate in terms of how many goals they score per power play, I find it's more helpful to look at things like how many shots are they generating per second. And that gives you a little bit of an inside window into what's going to happen in the future. And then all of a sudden, when things start to go right, then people say, well, what did they change? And very often, the only thing that changed is the passage of time.
So, do you think that, I kind of jumping ship on you here again. I was looking ahead at one of my questions, but around Patrick Waugh, for him to be the long-term coach of the Avs, do you think it is a perception thing, or is it going to come down to numbers and the sort of thing that is trackable? Like, he won this many, he lost this many. Because the first year, you could argue, was a fluke. I think you have to. Even though I'm a fan, weird things happened that year. We played extremely good hockey, and then we kind of came back to what I think we're really at as far as our level. But what do you think keeps or loses his job, and do you think he is a long-term coach?
So coaching evaluation is very, very difficult. And I think the odds are stacked against him in a way. I don't think it's a very easy transition to go from being a player, especially an elite player, to coaching. It's especially difficult too, because you can have an incredible roster who puts together an incredible season, and you still don't know if they did that because of the coach or despite the coach. And this is especially tricky with teams that are neither, you know, horrendously terrible or extremely good. Like, if you take, you know, like Buffalo last year, for instance, you know, I don't think anyone would look at any of the coaching records and say, well, that's, you know, that's clearly the coach's fault that they had that kind of record. So I'm really not comfortable making much of a pronouncement about any particular coach, because I don't have any access, not even in a theoretical, model-y, mathematical sort of way, of saying what would it have been like if they had had the same roster with a different coach.
What do you think are reasonable metrics to look at if you're looking at coaches? If you were to say they've been successful, would you say it's because, I mean, obviously wins versus losses, road wins maybe versus home wins or things like that can give you some insight, but what are fair metrics to even look at, do you think?
I think you would look at the willingness to scratch players who underperform. That's one of the things that I look for. That, you know, if I consider having a large bench to be a strength, and I think coaches should be rotating their players quite a bit. I don't have the data to back that up, but my intuition is that would help with conditioning, with injuries, with overcoming variance. It's the standard techniques of dealing with anything which is heavily varying is to create an equilibrium by having more variation yourself. So that I feel like it would be better if we didn't have this mentality that rookies had to earn spots and that veterans just had a lock on spots. I think it would be healthier if we moved people in and out a little bit more. But my coaching evaluation is much more intuitive than this, and it's largely based on individual decisions. Rather than any metrics, because I don't think we have any metrics that are good.
Well, I like what you said there. Actually, I didn't think of that at all, that you would do something more than just stuff you'd find on a stat sheet. Like, Waugh has a willingness absolutely to demote guys or to scratch them or send them to minors. I mean, I didn't see Zadorov, I think is how you say his name. Big Z is how I say it, because I don't like his last name. You know, he got sent down pretty quick, and he hasn't made a resurgence yet. And then you have other guys like Ginnett who are just always in the lineup. And I mean, why he's not about moving people around? What's that?
Even Ginnett's been scratched this year.
He has. I think he's in right now. And I saw a tweet recently that kind of got me thinking about that. He's not scratched as much as you would think, but we start to look at the alternatives. Unless you bring somebody back up from the minors, there's not a lot to work with right now. Redmond hasn't been amazing either.
Yeah, so player usage is probably my number one. And until we reach a place where all of the players, you know, most of the players most of the time on most of the teams are clearly NHL caliber, there will always be a test there where, you know, coaches who are consistently playing guys who they know are mediocre rather than players who could be very strong. I consider that a bit of a red flag, but then there's not just like we're going to play the guys who work out, like we're not just necessarily going to play the guys with the best ceiling. There's all sorts of meta questions there that are a pain. You know, if you play this guy for a certain number of games, then his entry-level contract doesn't slide. And, you know, that costs you money and cap in the long term, and so those things have to be balanced together. So that really complicates your analysis.
One of the best ways for me to learn that stuff was to actually play the DM mode on the hockey game I keep talking about.
Yeah.
It's fascinating to me. I think that I've kind of this connection together too, that you're just playing the game by itself. If you've ever played hockey, I think that you have these sort of mute neurons, or you have something going on to where you would be a better hockey player if you played more hockey on PlayStation, and especially if it was accurate as far as where you should be or the type of offense your team plays or how breakouts go. I think that when you got back on the ice, you would be better. And I think the same thing happens. Like, you care a lot more about stats when you're sort of in that sort of that gamified world. And I think that we see some improvements there too when it comes to that people are going to be smarter, better fans and stuff based on the simulations or the games that they do.
Yeah, there's a lot of
I find that pretty fascinating.
There's a lot of distaste for games. You know, they're considered silly and they're not real. But I think one of the sophisticated things that people have started to do is to take simulations and to add little game-like elements to them, and that people engage with them hugely without necessarily losing too much of the real content.
Yeah, I think it's really cool. I don't know if some of the other buzzwords right now, like the augmented realities or the Oculus Rift, things like that, are going to change the game much. But I think that for people who have played, just seeing things play out in front of them is like an Olympic diver would visualize his dive 20 times before he did it. I think there's actually something to it. And I hope that we start teaching people that way, not just the silly gamified version where it's all leaderboards and badges and things like that. But I think right. There's a science. I think that there's, you know, these people who are like Sid Meier's, who does Civilization, the guy just he understands the intrinsic qualities of a game that get people hooked and sucked in. And I think that some of that, where I'm going with this, is I think some of that is going to start coming into the game. I mean, right now, you and I can communicate throughout a game in a way we never did before. 10 years ago, you and I would not be on social media, like being a part of the game that way. We'd either have to be at the game together or, you know, tying up the phone at the house or something. But
yep.
I think that might be some of the future of the game too.
I agree.
And I hope it is, because like I said, I'm a geek. I love the technical side. So I've held you up for quite a while. I have a couple simple things. The last question I want to ask you, though, is if somebody wanted to be you, if they wanted to be just like you, maybe not the teacher side, but they wanted to bring visualizations and they wanted to use data in a meaningful way to hockey, what would they do? What sort of resources would you give a person like that, or advice?
So the number one thing is to have your own questions. You have to be able to scratch your own itch. You have to find something that you want to understand that you don't understand, and go after it. So that's where motivation and drive comes from. To because then even if you can't get it across to somebody else, you can at least get it across to yourself. And if you can be honest with yourself about not what you're doing accomplishes that, you know, that will give you a big in knowing if you're succeeding or failing. And after that, just put stuff out there. Just take what you've got and put it in front of as many people as you can. And especially if you consider yourself in the business of communicating, take to heart the fact that any time that you're not getting something across to somebody is a failure on your part. You know, maybe it's not very charitable of them. Maybe they didn't give what you're saying was a fair shake. Maybe they weren't very nice to you. But if your goal is to communicate with them and you don't, then that's on you. And there's sometimes to diagnose that in different ways. Sometimes it didn't come across because they don't care. In which case, you're not telling them what it is they want to hear. And sometimes you didn't get across because you used a particular color scheme that they couldn't because they're colorblind, in which case you have to think about those things. And so all of those levels of barriers to communication, you have to analyze one by one. So that's the only, not very good advice, I'm afraid.
I think it is. I think all through this, you've given good advice. I think you have a very scientific method of problem solving that is sound and legit. But I also think that you're onto something too, that there's, you know, the math is great, the visualizations make it even greater. And it sounds like you're kind of on your way too, to stepping those up a little bit. So I like it. I think infographics are the way that everything should work. If you can understand it well enough to simplify it down to an infographic and do that minimalism approach, you know more about it than you think you do, I think.
I would love to believe you.
Yeah. So one of my favorite quotes is, I would have written a longer letter if I had more time, or something like that.
Shorter letter.
Yes. Yes. I messed it up. You know the one though.
Yes, Blaise Pascal. I apologize for the length of this letter. I lack the time to make it short. Is definitely, I mean, there's no question that if you know what it is you're trying to say, then it's easier to take away all the other things. But that the process definitely goes in that direction, and so you can't be too scared about it. There's a lot of people who are so devoted to you know, clean design and minimalism that they don't really say anything at all. I think that's because they start with nothing and they try to add like a tiny, tiny smidgen of something. When I find instead the approach is almost always the opposite, where you throw in a huge amount and you fight with it to make, you know, the massive complexity legible. And then after that you say, okay, now that I know for sure that what I want is in here, how do I make it visible and how do I chip away the other stuff? So I think of it more like a process of removing what's extraneous rather than building a thing that's simple.
That's interesting though, the context you put that in, because I could care less about how beautiful one of Einstein's equations is in the end and how simple it is if I don't know how he got there, what the problem even was, or what he was trying to solve. I mean, it's cool. I like some of his equations. I have a big painting of him on my wall with many of the equations written on there, but I don't understand where they came from or why they're so, you know, important to people. But if you're in his world and you've been trying to solve this, or you've seen the math behind it or what he tried to make sense of, when it becomes that small, that clear, and that boiled down, I think there's certainly a beauty in that.
Absolutely.
But then again, he wasn't trying to communicate with me. He had some smarter friends.
Although, you know, even somebody like Einstein has like a clear public understanding of what they were doing.
Well, they, you know, he didn't have Twitter, but he was putting it out there too. He had many people that called him out. And I think that, I don't know if this is a quote that's applied to that or not, but I think that, you know, genius is insanity right up until it works. And in his case, it often was. And I think in some of the things we're talking about, it's true as well. Actually, you know, I heard that Forrest Griffin, MMA fighter. Interesting.
It's true though, that you can be overtaken by this idea that you have a particular thing that's so important and other people just have to come around to your way of looking at things. And I have been unafraid to take that heavy-handed approach sometimes, but you have to be very sure of yourself to do it.
And then if it's wrong, you have to take the ownership to say I was wrong and go another direction, which it sounds like, yes, it's really hard to do. But
it's difficult, and you know, and I'm as bad as anybody else at being, you know, thin-skinned and defensive, like I said, but that process of analyzing where you're wrong and constantly working on it is extremely good for you mentally, and it means your work is just hugely better all the time.
You're a smart man.
If you can stomach it.
All right, man. So I've taken up enough of your time, and this is really fascinating. I could talk to you for quite a while about all this, but let's try to keep this cool around an hour, and we're pushing an hour and a half.
Okay.
So do me a favor and just people know where they can find you and what you're up to, what your projects are now, or what your 2-year plan is. And then just, you know, your any links they can find you, HockeyViz, I think it is, and then your Twitter account.
Okay. So the place to find me is inevitably on Twitter, where I'm at ineffectivemath, and where you get almost a stream of consciousness of new viz of me slowly trying to understand hockey. The stuff which is a little bit more polished and a little bit more codified goes up on the website, which is hockeyviz.com. That's HockeyViz.com. And so there's new stuff that goes up every day. You can pay me a very small amount of money as my primary source of income. You can pay $10 a week or $10 a month and get early access to stuff. So you can have, you know, tomorrow's charts today. But the new project I'm presenting at, I'm hoping to present at the Ottawa Hawk Analytics Conference next month, and then there's another conference in Vancouver where I'm hoping to present in April. And the newest research is about, was two things I'm working on. One is, are there players who, whose primary effect on the game can be seen in other people's stats, like players who are pushing the puck up the ice, leaving the puck a little further towards the goal than they found it on average. I'm not sure if it's a thing, but I'm looking into it now. And I'm also looking at some quantification about whether or not certain players get ice time in high leverage states. Like, are there certain players who are being put out to protect leads in a way that's obviously more than other players? And if so, are they succeeding in that? Like, are there certain players who are actually good, who have a particular skill for playing in high pressure situations? Some people in the past have looked into that and found that it's not a very strong effect. I'm not sure about that, and so I'm looking at that again.
I think that's pretty fascinating. I'd be really interested to know, too, of those people, what are the age ranges, or if you profiled somebody? Because I know for the Avalanche, we'll put out a lot of our third and fourth line guys, because most of them are really experienced, or one guy's really strong on a faceoff, but I think that's fascinating. We definitely have to talk about that in the future, too.
Yeah, there's an existing body of research about this from social sciences generally. The military, for instance, has done research on this, and there's business research about who responds well in pressure situations. And we don't know if that's applicable to hockey. We don't know, maybe there's an argument that says, well, actually the talent level in hockey is all so incredibly high that there's not going to be much variation there, but we don't know that. And most of the attempts to measure it have been reasonably weak. So I'd like to have another go at that, at doing that in a systematic way and seeing what we can find there.
What's your feeling on it? You think you're going to get this, or you just enjoying the journey?
I'm not sure. It's very exploratory right now. My gut is that there will be an effect, that some players will actually be, to take a terrible phrase, be clutchier than other ones. But I think it's going to be reasonably small. I'm expecting it's going to be more like a talent that maybe, 10 players in the league have, and not, you won't necessarily have on every team people who are noticeably worse or better in particular situations.
One of the things I like about what you're saying and what you're looking at is that every time you bring something up, it just brings up another question in my head. So maybe that's the true test of, is this stuff interesting or worthwhile? Is that if you keep asking questions based on what you learned, that's a good thing, right?
Well, it's certainly interesting. I've got stuff to keep me busy until I die.
I think so, yeah. I think if you win a lottery, you're going to be a busy man still.
Hey, absolutely.
He is Micah Blake McCurdy, and he is awesome, as are you. Thank you for checking out this podcast. If you love it, be sure to subscribe, go to iTunes and search for Colorado Hockey, or just go to the website and click on the iTunes button. This podcast is both sponsored and supported by AvsFam, absfam.com, the coolest hockey shirts you're going to find anywhere. Go to www.avsfam.com and pick your favorite. One last note before we wrap this up. If you haven't caught the new episodes coming out called The Future of Hockey and Every Avs Player Ever, take some time and check those out. They're definitely shorter, but they're definitely awesome. And we think you're going to love them. So check them out and let us know what you think. Stay awesome.